From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Where does great art come from? The lonely artist in the attic or two friends who share a vision? We're talking about the fine art of creative collaboration today. Elizabeth Bishop was one of the 20th century's greatest poets. How much did she owe to her editors at The New Yorker? One of the country's top creative writing teachers talks about the impact a good teacher can have on her students. Also, Lonely Avenue, a new album featuring the words of British novelist Nick Hornby and the music of American singer-songwriter Ben Folds. And writer Joshua Wolf Schenk tells us about one of the most famous creative pairs of our time.
I think actually one of the paradoxes is that very successful social exchanges and these highly effective creative pairs that I'm studying, one of the characteristics is that they really know how to be alone.
That, of course, is the music of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Two people destined to make beautiful music together? Not so much, says writer Joshua Wolf Schenk. In his Creative Pairs series for Slate, Schenk writes that Lennon and McCartney did complete each other, but probably not in the way you might think. He says they weren't so much like chocolate and peanut butter as they were like an oyster and a grain of sand. Take, for example, their very first meeting, when Lennon was 17 and McCartney was almost 16.
The meeting between those two guys is a classic illustration of these Big Bang moments, of these explosions, these moments of chemistry and electricity that most creative pairs have at some point. It's not necessarily the first time they meet, but the people who describe John and Paul seeing each other for the first time, you know, they could almost feel the sort of feral sense in the air.
Somebody talking about that first meeting said that they were attracted to each other, but they also kind of circled each other.
Yeah, there's this fantastic image from one of the bandmates who was watching them, that they circled each other like cats. So there was an intense awareness and interest and also kind of wariness, because what they were about to embark on would be enormously vulnerable. I think this is one of the really important lessons of my study, that, you know, we venerate and romanticize electricity and chemistry. It's actually really hard to be with and to be around.
Well, and you look at Lennon and McCartney then, and as you pointed out, McCartney was more sweet, wrote more ballads. Lennon was more introspective, more bluesy, and together, neither one of them went too far off in their own direction, and both of them sort of saw the other as part of themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and took a lot of pleasure from it. Paul was so wistful in the years after the breakup and after John's death. There's one moment that stands out when he said, I think he actually sang it for the interview, "Getting Better All the Time," and then he sang John's part, you know, "Can't Get No Worse." He loved that. He loved that ballast and that balancing, and I think dependent on it. And I think even when they worked entirely alone in the Beatles years, they were so aware of each other that the collaboration was implicit in everything they did. And that helps explain why this idea that John and Paul were entirely separate in their later years as Beatles, I think, is totally wrong. And it helps explain why, even if they were doing a lot of writing on their own, why the work they produced as Beatles was so different than the solo work.
Well, give me an example. I mean, we all know of the Lennon-McCartney years, Lennon/McCartney. It was almost as though there were one thing. Even then, you suggest there was tension. McCartney, I think you said, represented loss of control to Lennon, and Lennon sort of represented bossiness or something to McCartney.
Yeah, well, there was tension from the beginning. I mean, to go back to this meeting scene, John remembered several times, it was a really poignant moment for him and really stood out, that when he saw Paul, he immediately recognized that here was a guy who was a better musician than him, and bringing him into the band would make the band better, would make him a better musician, but it also would mean that his undisputed role as the front man would be threatened. And he decided to take that risk, but that sense of, you know, who's in control and the importance of it to both men in their own way never dissipated. John really needed for people to think of him as the boss, and when he decided to act forcefully, he wanted everyone to listen. Paul's more kind of classic guy slightly in the shadows who didn't mind John having that perception of himself as the boss, so long as things were going the way Paul thought they should go. And for a lot of years, that worked just fine for them. Came to a head in a really ugly way around the breakup. And even then, I think the inherent beauty and depth of connection between them would have persisted were it not for a perfect storm, a cataclysm that wasn't fundamentally musical or even temperamental or relational, but had to do with these business crises that they had gotten themselves involved in a series of mistakes and misunderstandings. And even then, I think that the two of them were intensely aware of each other. I think it's a huge mistake to read Lennon's life in the 70s without acknowledging and understanding that he was intensely aware of Paul the entire time and vice versa.
Do you hear it in their music? I mean, are there songs that you can think of that each wrote separately, perhaps with the other in mind?
Yeah, I mean, John was sort of famously the sort of bluesy, risky one, but Paul wrote Helter Skelter. Yeah. A lot of times, you know, Paul would record these really raucous vocal parts and he would insist on doing it alone and not in harmony. You don't need to be a Freudian to see that this was an element of his competition coming out. John also wrote, in addition to his, a lot of, you know, very weird, very associative stuff, wrote a lot of very beautiful ballads.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because the thing that we all remember is the revolution that is John. But I wasn't aware until I read it in your piece that McCartney was the one who was actually out with a tape recorder doing loops of sound and odd things that maybe didn't get onto the albums, but that may have fed John's creativity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that their relationship is sort of, you know, one would dart ahead, the other would race to catch up, they would circle each other. This detail is a great one because John is remembered as the bizarre one and the risky one and the avant-garde one, when in fact, when they stopped living together, John moved to the equivalent of Westchester County for the New Yorkers. He moved to the suburbs. He moved where the bankers and stockbrokers lived. Paul was downtown. He was right around the corner from the studio, and he was out every night. John was home. John was a really introverted guy fundamentally, and often said that he was just scared by people. He needed a big impetus to go out. He really needed to rouse himself. He also was literally dropping LSD every day for a number of years and just sitting and watching television, occasionally writing music, whereas Paul would go home from the studio and head out, and he'd be out all night in what was, you know, one of the most interesting artistic environments in history, London in the 60s. And he's the one who, as you say, first experimented with experimental sounds and tape loops, and he did actually bring it and became the sound for, if I'm not mistaken, Tomorrow Never Knows. It's a very famous John song, and people associate the weirdness of it with John, but Paul was the one creating the sound. And I think then you have to say, so what's going on in the later years when John teamed up with Yoko and they did Revolution 9, and to what extent is that John saying, look, you think you're the weird one, I'm going to show you.
This is still the competition then. Was it George Martin who said they had a tug of war going all the time?
Yeah. George Martin's image is a beautiful one, that they were at the end of a rope, tugging all the time, pulling as hard as they could, smiling all the while. And he said the tension made for the bond. I love that image because I think it really captures something essential. We were talking earlier about the space between two people. And really, in a very basic way, my Slate series and the book I'm writing for the Penguin Press is a kind of biography of the space between creative people. And I think that space needs to be open, you know, just like two boxers in the ring, the way for them to avoid contact is to hug each other. You can't have creativity when you're actually fused, but you obviously can't have it, you know, when you're a million miles away. So the image of the tug of rope really kind of captures that moment and that space of tension in a beautiful way.
Maybe you could say it musically. Is there a composition, a Lennon-McCartney composition, that you think really sums up their relationship?
Oh, man, so many great ones. The first thing that pops in my head is We Can Work It Out, which is a great place where, you know, you have a song that was primarily written by Paul, or at least instigated by Paul, and you have these sort of darker hues, these minor notes that John brought in, and it just adds up to something so huge and beautiful.
Life is very short.
Two of Us is a great song. There are a lot of things going on. Paul said it started because Linda suggested that they just go off driving to the middle of nowhere, and that's the first verse of the song.
Two of us riding nowhere, spending someone's modern day. You and me Sunday driving.
But when you get into the heart of it, it really feels like, you know, one partner in a relationship that is on its way to estrangement, really plaintively calling out. And there's great tape of the two of them playing around with that song in the studio, this ostensibly miserable time. They were miserable in a lot of ways. You know, these business fights were just total nightmare. But when they got together and were playing together, the pleasure is totally palpable.
We're on our way home. We're on our way home. We're going home.
We're going home. You better believe it. Goodbye.
The Beatles with Two of Us from their final studio album, Let It Be. Joshua Wolfshank is the author of the Creative Pairs series for Slate. He's also writing a book about the subject. How about you? Do you have a favorite creative pair in music, the other arts, science, business, or philosophy? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll explore the literary side of creative pairs. The director of the Iowa Writers' Workshop talks about her novel, which explores how creative writing professors influence their students. And we'll find out how the New Yorker's editors shaped the work of one of the most important American poets of the 20th century, Elizabeth Bishop, as we continue our Hour on Creative Pairs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The Iowa Writers' Workshop is one of the most well-known and influential creative writing programs in the world. Lan Samantha Chang knows it well. She attended as a student, and she now directs the workshop. So maybe it's no surprise that her new novel examines the relationship between the students and a professor in a creative writing program somewhere in the Midwest. The novel's called All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. Lan Samantha Chang sat down to talk with Steve Paulson and to read from a new book.
Miranda Sturgis was an exceptional poet. Among the school's distinguished faculty, she was the brightest star, and graduate students fought to gain admission to her seminars. It was 1986, and the most fervent feared they had missed the age of poetry, that they were born into the era of its decline. To Miranda and the school, they came in defiance of that decline, or at the very least, to sit for 2 years in the circle of her radiance. They yearned to know her mind and hoped to earn her blessing as they set forth on an uncertain path. But Miranda was critical of their work and dismissive of their hopes. She rarely offered praise. She discussed their poems ruthlessly, as if they were not in the room. Of the students in her classes, almost none escaped unaltered or unscathed, and some stopped writing altogether. Such was her teaching that the students at the school had invented a special nickname for her critiques. They were called bludgeonings, as in, he's drunk, he's just been bludgeoned. Out in the world, the small, passionate world of poetry, Miranda maintained a sterling reputation as a teacher. There was learning and acuity in her body of work, the shimmering debut, the rigorous and ambitious second book, the third book shortlisted for several major national prizes. She was considered an accurate and influential judge of talent. It was rumored that she sometimes took a special interest in the career of a young poet, and that her protégés began with a vital advantage. And so, despite the bludgeonings, despite confusion and hurt feelings, the students kept lining up to take her classes. They concealed their discouragement from their families, most of whom did not read poetry, from the school, of whose faculty she was by no means the worst instructor, and from Miranda herself, because they sensed, with the visceral knowledge of neglected children, that if they were to complain to her, she would not notice. Instead, they watched her keenly. They studied how she dressed and how she did her hair. They puzzled over the hesitant yet determined way she gestured as she spoke. They tried to copy these habits as if they could learn to be Miranda, could transform their own young hands, grasping their pens, into her delicate, reluctant hands.
Why were you so interested in this subject, the aura that a famous writer can wield over her students?
Well, I began as a student myself. Back in the dark ages, I got my MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1993.
Where you are now the director.
Where I am now the director. And I just remember that back in the day, our teachers were these powerful, powerful personages to us. They were like gods to us. I'm not saying everybody felt that way, but I think a large number of us looked at our teachers as kind of immovable forces, these great and powerful deities who would be able to predict what direction our lives would take. If they liked our work, then perhaps we would have good lives as writers. If they did not like our work, then we might as well give up.
Now, there are stories about this kind of thing and stories that you have in your book about what happens to a student whose work has been ripped apart by one of these powerful teachers. I mean, they go to pieces. They weep about it.
Yes.
Does that kind of thing happen?
Yes, it does. In the very first scene of my book, a young woman is critiqued and bursts into tears. And I've seen this happen myself. When I was in the program, someone fainted, for example. That's another kind of reaction people can have. I don't think that the students themselves understand that they, too, have a kind of power in the classroom. And I don't think that, certainly in that day, it wasn't as obvious as it is now. The thing about the extremely harsh class is that it causes everyone to get up on their toes and try really hard. But sometimes people stop, it fails, and someone will be silenced. And I think that is the great problem with that kind of class, that it actually can silence some writers. They stop writing entirely. They can't get that bad class out of their minds.
So you've seen that happen. I mean, maybe a writer who has some promise but then goes in front of one of these brutal critiques and that's it. They are shattered.
Absolutely, I've seen that happen. As Miranda says in my book, perhaps, though, something else would have shattered them. Hmm. Bad review, you know, rejection from a journal. An artist's life is filled with rejection, and there's no way to get around it. And I think that back in the day when this story is set, it was par for the course that the teachers would do some of the rejecting.
Of course, what makes this all very interesting is that you are the director of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the most famous writers' program in America, the most influential. I mean, you have enormous power doing that. And I mean, it's more than a little intriguing that you've written a book about the teacher-student dynamic at a writing program, which presumably has some similarities to the one that you teach at.
Yes, I don't teach the way that Miranda does, actually. I think back to the days when I was a student with a certain nostalgic wistfulness. It's certainly not like that in the classroom anymore. Nobody is bludgeoned. Nobody, in my class anyway, has ever left in tears. I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I don't think I could teach the kind of class where people suffered that kind of violence. If I knew about it, I would want to make it better.
Now, one of the underlying questions in your novel and in all creative writing programs is whether writing can really be taught. I mean, we know the mechanics. The craft can be honed, but can talent be taught?
Yes, that is one of the big questions in my book. I think that talent cannot be taught. It can be encouraged. I don't think it's possible to bring everyone up to the same level of accomplishment. But I do think it's possible for a teacher to encourage students to do much, much better in a much shorter time than they would have if they hadn't studied. I think that what people generally say about creative writing programs is that they teach people how to save time, that they save years that they might have spent sort of pursuing writing on their own by coming into a community of writers, being encouraged, being given the time and support to write, and being critiqued.
Could you tell me about one of your teachers, maybe someone who did have an influence on you and sort of what that person, what you learned from that person?
James Allen McPherson, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for his book Elbow Room and a MacArthur Genius Award winner. He's a very mild-mannered person, very quiet person. He rarely speaks in class. He lets the students speak and then will say a few words. Very early on in my time at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I was in Jim's workshop, and he said, as an offhand comment, that not very many people write ghost stories anymore, that it was a form that people weren't pursuing. And I could tell from the way he said it that he thought that was a shame. And I started thinking about ghost stories. I went to the library in Iowa City and looked up ghost stories, and I discovered volumes of sort of hand-typed, independently published accounts of local ghost stories that had been bound up and put in the library. And I read them and I began to see that they all had something in common, which was that there was a story in life that wasn't finished. And the ghost came as an attempt to finish off the incomplete story. And this was so interesting to me that I began to think of what kind of story would lead to a haunting. And I believe that the pursuit of ghost stories kept me going for the next, 8 years in writing.
So you wrote ghost stories yourself then?
They were ghost stories. They were not obviously ghost stories, but there were often characters in the stories that were haunted. My first book, Hunger, contained several stories in which an actual ghost existed. And I don't think Jim had any idea when he made that comment how long I would chew over it, how relentlessly I would pursue it. I've always been grateful to him for saying that.
I mean, it's fascinating because it almost sounds like it was sort of an offhand comment that he made and it changed your life.
Absolutely an offhanded comment. In other words, what the teacher thinks that they're getting across isn't necessarily what the student's going to receive. And the student could receive something that the teacher has no idea they were putting across. Jim knows this, and that's one of the interesting things about his teaching. He's very, very unassuming. He doesn't think that he has the right to pronounce judgment on the work of others. On the other hand, I had a teacher when I was at the workshop, the former director, Frank Conroy, who was another kind of teacher entirely, and many people think a great, great teacher. And I also liked Frank very much and learned an enormous amount. Frank was the person who made people cry. Frank had absolute judgment, sat in absolute judgment over the student's work. And he knew exactly what he liked and what he didn't like.
And he had no reservations about expressing
and no
qualms that he might be wrong.
He was absolutely certain that he was right. And there's a certain pleasure in coming into a classroom with a teacher like that, because you know that what you're getting is straight from the hip. They're shooting from the hip. That is the kind of teacher Miranda is in my book. The pleasure of that kind of teacher is enormous. You sort of gird your loins for class as if you're going into a kind of battle. One funny anecdote from the days of Frank. Frank used to discuss two stories per class, and he would put his favorite story, the one that he thought was good, second. Everybody knew this. Frank never said a word. So you would sit when you were in that class, you would sit in there wondering whether your story would be discussed first or second. And if it was first, you knew that he didn't think it was so great. And if it was second, you felt good and you could relax in your chair, because Frank would argue down anybody who disagreed with him. But the funny thing about it was that people felt really insecure about this also. And they went and they talked to the program administrator and said, gosh, you know, I don't think Frank is very nice. he makes it really clear whose work he doesn't like. She went to him and said, Frank, you know, the students feel that they can always tell which story you like the best. You always put that one second. And he said, really? Okay. And from then on, he always put his favorite story first.
Which sort of defeats the purpose.
Exactly, exactly.
Len Samantha Chang is the author of the novel All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. She's also the director of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Chang spoke with Steve Paulson. Elizabeth Bishop was one of the great poets of the 20th century. She didn't write a lot, but everything she did write had a kind of perfection to it, even though her subjects were anything but poetic. She wrote about ordinary things, like fishing and sitting in a dentist's waiting room. Most of Elizabeth Bishop's work was published in The New Yorker magazine, and now, thanks to writer Joelle Beale, we can get a first-hand glimpse of how Bishop and her editors collaborated. Beale recently edited a book called Elizabeth Bishop and the New Yorker, The Complete Correspondence. She told Anne Strainchamps what happened to Bishop's poems when they were submitted to the New Yorker.
The poem would come in, let's say, to Catherine White, and she would read it and decide whether she wanted the poem or not. Whether she said yes or no, she had to bring it to another editor to get a vote, which would usually be Howard Moss, but it could be someone else who was on hand, like William Maxwell. And then they would vote on it. If they were both a no, the poem would go immediately back to Elizabeth Bishop. But if they were a no and a yes, or a yes and a yes, the poem would either go to editor-in-chief Harold Ross when he was there, or later to William Shawn. And Shawn and Ross had final say. So if they said no, that was it, even if White and Moss were a yes.
Boy, this is a complicated system of checks and balances. Sounds like the American government.
And they were very guarded in how they would let Bishop know about the votes. They loved to use the royal we. And I asked an old-time editor there, I said, why did you use we? And they said, we never wanted, you know, anyone to be mad at any one of us individually. We just said the votes were a no. And they didn't want to reveal who voted how.
You never got to know who the Russian judge was.
So things were often phrased in the passive voice when you got your things back. So, for instance, with the shampoo, Catherine White says, the votes were mixed, but the nose had it in the end.
Well, how did Bishop respond when her work was rejected? That must have been hard for her.
It was. I think the shampoo was a particularly difficult rejection for her.
The shampoo?
this poem, The Shampoo, which was about washing Lotus Juarez's hair. The reason why it was probably rejected is because it was an openly lesbian love poem, and The New Yorker did not publish anything that had to do with homosexuality. And I think Bishop took the rejection quite personally, since she knew all of the editors and they knew of her sexuality, and they had been writing back and forth about Bishop's time in Brazil and her relationship with Lota. They'd known of her other relationships. And I think she took the rejection then quite personally, because they accepted her, or they seemed to accept her, as friends. But when it came to publishing something, they wouldn't do it.
Hmm. Now, I'm curious about the editing part of poems, because I guess until I read some of these letters, it hadn't really occurred to me that that much work would go into editing a poem. But one of the recurring topics of correspondence between Bishop and her editors at The New Yorker is punctuation.
Yeah. I think the source for that goes back to Harold Ross, who founded the magazine and had previously been a newspaper editor, and whose mother had been a grade school teacher. I think he took the lessons she taught him into the newspaper business, and he applied those rules to the magazine and to poetry, to the captions and cartoons. Everything, punctuation-wise, had to be perfect. So even as far as poems had to be cleared for libel, poems had to be fact-checked just as if they were a newspaper story.
How do you fact-check a poem?
If there is any reference to a historical figure, if a mythological figure comes up, they were checked to see if they actually existed. There was a poem once by Theodore Ruthke, and he made up a biblical figure called the Mother of Har. And they questioned the Mother of Har. And Ruthke's response was, well, if the Mother of Har didn't exist, she should have.
Oh, she does now.
So they were checked. In the poem In the Waiting Room, there was discussion about the fictitious date. The photos Bishop is referring to do not occur in the February 1918 issue. So that was checked and discussed.
And when it got to the punctuation, what sort of punctuation issues came up?
Well, the style guide for The New Yorker was Fowler's Modern English Usage. And so they just lived and died by Fowler's. And with Bishop, they were especially strict, one of the editors had told me, since she had a reputation for being a very exacting poet. And they were very concerned that anything unusual on her part, anything out of the ordinary, might look like a mistake on either her part or theirs. And so they were very sure to follow things with Fowler for her poetry, whereas with some other poets, let's say W.S. Merwin, who had no punctuation, he was allowed to do that because that was his thing. Or in the 70s, there were some other poets who were more playful with punctuation, but that was their reputation. How much The New Yorker gave Bishop that reputation, it could be a whole other subject, because she was sending in poems that played with punctuation from the very beginning.
How important is punctuation in poetry?
Well, it has to do, I think, with pacing and, for Bishop, turns of thought, tonal varieties. Bishop's poetry often wants to enact a mind thinking, and so the commas will indicate pauses, maybe the mind going back on itself, rethinking something, revising it, and going forward. And The New Yorker did not, for Bishop in particular, like to see punctuation to be used for effects, as in music, a short pause or a longer pause, let's say. They didn't believe in that, and they wanted to use it kind of by the book.
So something as simple as the placement of a comma could really change the way you read a line of poetry?
It can. It can. In Bishop, it can.
Huh. Do you have a favorite letter or exchange of letters about punctuation?
Yes, I do. This is about At the Fish Houses, which Bishop sent to Catherine White in February 1945. When she sent it in, she called it an unusable poem, and they were delighted with it and wanted to buy it right away. When the proof was made up, Catherine White wrote Elizabeth Bishop, and the date for this letter is February 25th, 1947. and she says, "Dear Miss Bishop, our proof room, which has a highly conventional idea of punctuation, had scores of punctuation queries on the Fish Houses poem. But we have eliminated the major portion of them, since your lack of punctuation is purposeful and adds to your effect. Will you please study the few commas now suggested and see whether you approve? I only left in the ones I thought would really help the reader, but you may not agree. In this case, it should be as you want it. Sincerely, Catherine S. White." February 28, 1947. "Dear Mrs. White, I think the proof looks very nice, and thank you for your help with the punctuation. I have left in all your changes except the commas between cold, dark, deep that occurs twice. For some reason or other, it seems more liquid to me without them, and I think in this case the sense is plain enough without them, don't you? I notice that quite a few tails of P's and Y's, etc., are missing, but I imagine that is just because it's proof. Sincerely yours, Elizabeth Bishop."
What happened in the case of those commas? Did they stay in or stay out?
There was no more correspondence about the commas, and so they ended up staying in. What I love about this exchange is how Bishop sets up her defense, which she begins it very softly with, "for some reason or other," and then she moves on to describe it as liquid, which I think gives a real sense of the effects she wanted to create. And then she embroidered the rest of the sentence with a rhetorical question with, "I think in this case the sense is plain enough without them, don't you?" And White ended up agreeing.
"Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown."
That's a recording of Elizabeth Bishop reading the end of her poem at the Fish Houses in 1974. Bishop died in 1979. Joelle Beal is the editor of Elizabeth Bishop and the New Yorker, The Complete Correspondence. Beal spoke with Ann Strainchamps. Do you have a favorite Elizabeth Bishop poem? We'd love to know what it is. And do you think creative writing can be taught? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll hear what happens when a British novelist writes lyrics for a singer-songwriter to set to music as we conclude our hour on creative pairs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Ben Folds is a singer-songwriter from North Carolina. Used to have his own band, Ben Folds 5. But in more recent years, Folds has struck out on his own and released solo albums full of witty lyrics accompanied by his evocative piano playing. He recently joined forces with Nick Hornby, the critically acclaimed novelist from England, and the two collaborated on an album called Lonely Avenue. As you might guess, Hornby wrote the lyrics and Folds wrote the music. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon talked to Folds about working with Hornby to create Lonely Avenue.
Ben Folds and Nick Hornby have been friends since the mid-1990s.
I think we were mutual fans early on. I was reading his first novels, and he was listening to my first records. He was at our first gig in London. And I didn't know that. I would have been very nervous because I was reading High Fidelity at the time.
In Songbook, Hornby heaped high praise on the Ben Folds song Smoke. Hornby wrote, "Smoke is one of the cleverest, wisest songs about the slow death of a relationship that I know." At the time, Hornby didn't know that the lyrics were not written by Folds, but by Anna Goodman, Folds' ex-wife. Folds knew right away how special the lyrics were.
I knew they were good lyrics, and what's funny about it is that they weren't my lyrics, and I normally write my lyrics. She's a great writer. She writes letters that read that way. She just can't help it. I guess I've known Anna since I was 5 years old. You know, I remember she played piano as well. She used to be playing piano like in first grade after school. And if I was after school, I could hear her playing like ragtime and made me want to play piano. So she was actually a big influence. Yeah, I know what she writes is great. And it gets better each time. I mean, each time I play it, literally, I find something else in it.
Leaf by leaf and page by page, throw this book away. All the sadness, all the rage, throw this book away. Rip out the mind in and tear the glue, and all of the grief we never even knew. We had it all along, now it's smoke.
Folds contributed to the power of Smoke by creating a poignant melody in waltz time. Did he know from the beginning that it was going to be in three-quarter time?
It implied that, but I think you can put lyrics in lots of time signatures and lots of phrasing. There's so many possibilities. When you see a page and it's just got words, and this is the way I was working with Nick. He sent me the email. It had completed lyrics in it, and I just find looking for the melody that brings out the most in the lyrics that doesn't step on them, which is really easy to do.
Each of the songs on Lonely Avenue is a story told from a different character's point of view, which is not surprising since Hornby is a novelist. But Folds also writes a lot of songs featuring characters.
I like characters. I mean, characters are harder to write in songs. You need more space, more time to do it. That's why, you know, when you hear story songs or they're folk songs, they might have like 8 verses, and the verses are fairly simple, and they keep repeating and repeating, and that gives you a chance to just concentrate on the lyrics and let them build. You know, the detail is very important in a 3.5-minute song. If you've only got a few verses, if you're going to build a character, it really needs to be implied through those little moments that resonate. And one has to have a really good instinct of what those are. Obviously, Nick does.
Woke up this morning. What do I see? 3,000 cameras pointed at me. Dude says you leave, I'm like, yes, that's me, sir. Well, you just knocked up the VP nominee's daughter. So I tell him, no, you got it wrong, mister. Already got a girl, her name's Bristol. And say, where you been, sonny? Your mother-in-law's a heartbeat from the presidency. So I say, mother-in-law, no, we ain't getting married. They say, soon you will, boy. She just announced it. I get on my dirt bike and ride to my girls. I'm gonna lay down. Going on.
song called Levi Johnston's Blues.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
One of the most beautiful songs on Lonely Avenue is a ballad called Belinda. The book that accompanies the CD includes an email that Fold sent to Hornby about how hard it was to set the lyrics for Belinda to music.
Many things about the song came very easily. The chorus came easily. The problem was that he quoted the chorus in the first verse. In fact, in the second line of the first verse. That's a problem because you've given away the place that you're going. There aren't many places to go in a pop song, and you've sort of taken away the one place that we're all going really early. So I had to figure out a way to make it basically the same melody, weaken the chords a little bit, and then find a way in the chorus to make you feel that it was a surprise. Because that's what's great about the chorus. It lifts you up, and there's something that's some sort of lift or surprise. So I set the chorus, I think, sort of late by a couple of beats or half a bar or something. I can't remember what I did, but I had to mess around with these things to make it work. The other thing is that the chorus was supposed to be, he's quoting a chorus, fictitious on this, supposed to be a massive hit from the early 70s. That means that my chorus, if the melody didn't sound like a massive hit from the early 70s, I failed. So it really had to do all those things. So that took a little bit more time.
Every night around this time, he has to sing Belinda. Belinda, I love you. Don't leave me. I need you. He tried to stop a while back, but what is he without her? A one-hit wonder with no hits is what he is. And anyway, he always hears how much it means to people. There's a lot of 40-somethings who wouldn't be in the world without it. So now he does it with this lyric in his head. Belinda, I loved you. I'm sorry that I left you. I met some younger on a plane. She had big breasts and a nice smile. No kids either. She gave me complimentary champagne. She gave me complimentary champagne.
I was curious if part of the challenge was the fact that Folds was dealing with Hornby's words rather than his own. Folds said in a Time magazine interview a few years ago that he always wants to push the barrier a little bit with lyrics, and he didn't have the chance to do that here. But Folds didn't see that as an issue.
Just in his style, he's already pushing something. There's a thumbprint about his writing that I think is pretty obvious in the first few lines of each song. In being Nick Hornby, in my opinion, he's already pushing it. I don't need to be the one that writes the lyrics. The music is inspired to me by how I feel about what's happening. It's like interpretive dance would be for some people, or maybe, you know, like, you know, a child has made a drawing of, you know, a witch making him clean up his room and it's raining and, you know, he's sad and they're like, why are you sad, Johnny? I don't know why I'm sad. I just, you know, you can interpret these things. And music is like that for me. The problem is when I write the music first, it's come out of some way that I feel. But I'm not exactly sure, any more than the child is sure, why he drew that picture. I don't know why I made the music, and it's my job to find the lyrics, which I think is very difficult. With Nick, he's already painted a world for me. So I read those, I sit inside them, and then I create the music to that, and then the whole thing is finished. So it's easy for me.
Since Folds is from North Carolina and Hornby is from England, I was curious about whether Hornby's lyrics included any British vernacular that Folds had trouble with.
There could have been, but Nick's really good at writing for characters, and I think he realized that I was singing. You know, there's the odd reference to a place in London, like in Picture Window, but he's pretty good at that. I mean, like a long way down, he's got 4 to 6 characters going at one time from completely different walks of life, and 3 of them are American, I think. It's all believable. He's just really good at that. He probably could have thrown me a curveball if he wanted to, but he was being kind.
They checked into the hospital New Year's Eve. Nothing to be done about that.
rainbows, daffodils, she's not naive. Symbolism's all crap. And there's a big picture window in the room on the ward with the view over Parliament Hill. But the view offers more joy than they can afford. When there's this much pain to kill, you know what hope is. Hope is a bastard. Hope is a liar, a cheat and a tease. Hope comes near you, kick his backside. Got no place in days like these.
In this clip from a promotional video for Lonely Avenue, Folds and Hornby talk about how they think the album turned out.
The record sounds a lot better than I imagined it would. I imagine this to be more of a, have more of a side project feel in every way, that and that would be really a cool thing. That would be good. It'd be something, you know, we would both be posing against a white background like that. Like it would be a coffee shop record. This week.
But I mean, it would just be a one coffee shop.
Yeah, yeah, one place. Yeah, we'd just be, and we'd be sitting at the table actually selling it ourselves.
Ben Folds collaborated with Nick Hornby on the album Lonely Avenue. Folds spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 327B, Creative Pairs. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.